government policies, objectives of government policies. And I went to Margaret with great enthusiasm and found, you know, having given out land, they discovered that just giving a peasant a piece of land is insufficient. You must assist him to clear the land, do some soil conservation, build a hut. And a certain amount of money, 25,000 rupees, was given to the Matra Kachri. So I thought, this was a progressive step. I called for a paper to find out what had happened. And to my amazement, I found a comment in the administration report. The peasant in this Matra district is so unenterprising that he will not even take advantage of monies offered to him for these services. Maybe rash, but in my first diary I said I read this comment and I'm certainly not prepared to subscribe to it without careful investigation as to whether the peasant knows of the good intentions of the government. My GA came on me like a ton of hot bricks that I was critical of my predecessor. However, I checked on it and I found that the peasant knew nothing about it. A letter came from the Kachari. GA wrote and said, notify the Mudlia. The letter went to the Mudlia, which means the Mudlia's office. Just that. That was, you know, the concept of government moving on. But there was resentment from the old school that here was somebody critical of what had happened and was prepared to say so.
Yeah, that's it was you.
Yes.
In fact, Davidson himself told me directly and others implied that there were few who were almost sabotaging this land development ordinance in the sense that they didn't like Brain and his ways.
Yes, you see, the Brain, there were the old school that they felt that Brain was too much of a goody-goody missionary type. There was the others who were friendly towards the planting interests who felt if you want land developed, that's private capital waiting to take it over and develop it. Why don't you give it to them? And why do you want to waste your time, money, effort on giving it to the peasants who just mess it up and allow the soil to be eroded? But I must say, working in the district, most of the chaps who worked in the district keenly supported the new land policies. There was Brain, there was Davidson, there was Sands, there was a Leach, Hudson, all I worked with made an honest effort. I think, coming with a tradition for systematic work, a better effort than is being made even today to implement the land development ordinance in all its implications, that it is a tenancy converted to a grant, a freehold, restricted freehold. In its fullness, I think there was an honest effort made by it.
Do you know of any instances when the Secretariat even tried to restrict or to squash innovations with the GA's proposal, rather than mere sort of AGA's or its assistants?
Yes. It happens all the time. If you have a boss who doesn't like change, you write a report and he says, only the other day a chief engineer came and said, how many proposals I made, and it was put, filed and dished out. Nobody read it. It happens. But if you really interested in getting innovation under the present system, writing a memorandum and sending it up will not produce results. You got to sell the idea, possibly on a verbal level, to your minister and make the minister feel that he has a grand new idea, that things could start moving, otherwise no new concept gets charged.
So kind of lobbying process?
Yes, you lobby, or you get your minister to, you know, win his support, and then it gets done.
Were GAs of the old school willing even to disobey directives if they could get away with it in general interest? Sometimes pretend they hadn't received a letter and act and then face the consequences.
No, they were, if they disagreed, they would have written back. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't, the chaps whom I had worked with, they would have promptly written back and said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I don't think this is not the correct thing to do, but if you persist, then we'll do it, but this is not the correct thing to do." On many occasions, Hudson has written back and said, no, I don't think this is the correct thing, but if it bother me too, I'll do it.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking of the question of orthodoxy in the service of the old days, simply because Saparamadu, in his introduction to Wolfe's diaries, mentioned this impact of the stressors, I should say, the impact of the civil service tradition, and goes and even says that civil servants were generally cast into a mold. Would you comment on that?
They were not, I wouldn't say they were cast into a mold. It was so easy to fit into a mold, and a very comfortable mold. It was more comfortable before the Depression than after the Depression. You belong to the highest income group. You joined the best social circles. You were invited to the best social circles. And you were in the round of easy living. Possibly in the process you lost your social conscience and you did the minimum of the day's work and you went to the club and you had a good time, you had a party. I don't think there was a conscious effort to put you into a mold. Certainly in the 1930s, C.L. Vikramasinghe made a conscious effort to get people to have a social conscience. There was an effort by some. There was a group who were, one of the first things that happened to me the first week in service, I was impressed into joining the Orient Club. You were invited to, but I don't think that, and you may have fitted into a mold, a pattern in living, not very conscious effort to.
No, and thinking of in terms of personnel and specific examples, I no doubt that some fitted into this round. But now, for instance, taking the 1920s, I can't see people like C.L. and Leach and Davidson and others, and even the hard-drinking types. There were some who drank hard, but who also worked hard.
Yes, they worked hard.
And say Strong, for instance, I can't see them being described as being of a mold.
You see, the public had an impression of a civil service mold. Those who were within the civil service never felt so much individuality among their colleagues. I don't think there was a mold. But again, you see, I could understand the public thinking that they belonged to a mold because of certain advantages they enjoyed.
Mm-hmm. And taking a sort of more recent situation, how is the bureaucracy facing up to this now, to the heavy social and economic role that they have, for the responsibilities which they have to bear?
You know, there have been a lot of factors have played on the public service in recent years. The importance of language, race, religion, all have had their effect on the cohesiveness of public service. That morale has been pretty low for a long time as a result of some getting, rightly or wrongly, a feeling whatever you do, it doesn't matter. You never get to the top. Mm-hmm. Some feeling whatever you do, it doesn't matter. You will get to the top. So, no, neither party worked. You see? So, the problems have increased. There is some conscious effort to tackle the problems, but I don't know whether there is a conscious response and a sense of urgency in the public service to tackle these problems.
And thinking in terms of Sirini's character and general trends, both among ministers and administrators, hasn't there been a tendency to take ad hoc measures to temporize?
Yes, I remember, you know, possibly a decision that cost this country anything up to 1,000 million rupees,
yes,
was taken off the cuff. What my doorstep in Anuradhapura, but Sir Oliver Gunatilaka. The decision to increase the price of paddy from 9 rupees to 12 rupees and to guarantee it.
To the producer?
To the producer, guaranteed for a period of 4 years. Mm-hmm. At the time there was a case, I pressed for the increase in price. The price of rice that we were buying in Burma was equivalent to 12 rupees. We were paying something like 84 pounds per ton. I said, I see no reason why, if you're prepared to pay 84 pounds per ton to the producer in Burma, but you should not give it to the producer in Ceylon. I was in charge of a district where extensive rice, I said it would be great incentive.
So it would be in the 1950s then?
1952, 53, mm-hmm. Just after the Korean boom, and the price was going up. So they said, right, we'll do so. The elections are coming off soon. We will guarantee our price. And very soon he made that statement, and it came. He came to Colombo, and a decision was made.
Well, while he had made it off the cuff, presumably you hadn't. So, does this apply? This?
No, I had a reason for offering it,
mm-hmm.
But I had no. I made no proposal that it should be guaranteed as a perpetual price. I was working in the background of a fluctuating price, equating the internal price to the external price.
Yes, I see. Mm-hmm. It would be a sliding...
Yeah, fluctuation. As the supply and demand vary, prices would vary. Well, having guaranteed it for a period with an ulterior objective, well, it became a burden to the extent of... we were paying double the world market price.
In fact, have you any idea what led up to the other decision taken earlier, I think in 51, to subsidize the price with regard to the consumer too?
You know, I was, Mr. A. Ratnayake was Minister for Home Affairs,
right.
And he told me a story that there was great pressure by government servants for a cost of living allowance, and the government was flushed with cash, Korean boom. So at the cabinet, when this proposal was being considered, Mr. Ratnayake claims, he raised the question, why should we only subsidize, give us relief to public servants, why not the rest of the island? And he said, we will cut the price of rice. We will subsidize the public servants and we will cut the price of rice. Okay. Everybody said, You know, the cost of it was never carefully analyzed. Its long-term implications were never understood. It was a decision off the cuff.
Mr. Ratnakar was responsible for suggesting free education too, so he's cost us quite a lot.
He's writing his reminiscences to some paper. I don't think this story comes out because he told me the story. No, that is one of the serious defects of administration in Ceylon. Very important decisions are made off the cuff. And the permanent service has never been trained to asking people to, policymakers to stop. If we will give you the implications of alternatives and make a decision with an awareness of the alternatives. Well, this time when we had the food crisis last year, certainly we did attempt to tackle this problem of rice subsidy. The government appointed a small committee, I was chairman of that committee, to implications of the rice subsidy and its projection for the next 5 years, what it will cost, and possible alternative methods of taxing it. Certainly not one of the methods was a free measure, but we did produce a report with possible alternatives, and the government saw it, they said, locked it up. I don't think more than 3 members of the cabinet read it, because they've been so frightened to tackle it. When suddenly this crisis occurred and somebody said, you'll give a free rice, again a snap decision was made.
At this point, the original spool was reversed. The interview is continued.
I was wondering whether the prospect of what it would cost in 5 years wouldn't have been so frightening that they were willing to look at the alternatives you suggested. I mean, both are frightening.
They were frightening, but they did appreciate that something had to be done. That more than 30% of the resources of the country would go into projected revenue of the country, would go into the subsidy. But again, they were overwhelmed at the, you see, the fear of a repetition of 1953.
Mm-hmm. Or even the troubles the SLFP had to face within its own party when Felix
proposed it.
Coming back to the administration itself, it would seem that this method of corporations has been an attempt to give some sort of flexibility to government activity. Has it?
You know, in many ways, yes. Under normal departmental administration, if you want to do something, you've got to get monetary provision, make provision in the budget. That means if you want to spend money, you know, on the 1st of October, you've got to make a proposal on sometime in November, December.
And the previous year.
The previous year. You have to answer a lot of questions from not very informed persons in the Treasury. Mm-hmm. Looking at it purely from the point of view, with our scarce resources, can we invest on this, and can we do this, and can we do that? Then, having got the monetary provision, you want to spend the money. You tied down to all the procedures laid down for the expenditure of government money, the sanctions you have to obtain. Even if you want to buy a piece of red tape, you got to advertise it. You've got to call for tender. You've got to find out who is the lowest tenderer. You summon a tender board, present your report to the tender board, and make a decision. When government launched into commercial activities, you could not possibly make this title. So legislation that has been enacted gives very wide powers of decision making to the public corporations. But having given those wide powers, there have been regulations which have directions, which have reimposed all the controls on the corporation. But yet, the corporations, by law, enjoy the powers. And any corporation which honestly wants to do get on with the job of work can get on with the job of work, much less hampered and tied down by routines.
From where did these other directives come, you know?
You see, the point is, there may have been one incident, some corporation and did not call for tenders, and somebody went and told a minister that I had a cheaper product, but these just never asked me. They put it to their favorite it and got it. So the minister told the finance minister, and the finance minister wrote a fiat that they shall in future follow government procedure, tender procedure. And there it is. It becomes a directive from, but if the corporation wants to get, but the great effect of the public corporations in Ceylon is that it was an institutional device we borrowed from British experience, new in Britain. We have distorted it in that we have appointed persons who had no conception of their responsibilities to be in charge of these organizations. We have used the corporations as rewards for political service. We have never taken the CTB. You know, it's a huge organization. I functioned as chairman for a period, and I was amazed. The revenue of the CTB in 1964-65, when I joined it as chairman, was higher than the revenue of the government of Ceylon in the year that I joined the government service. It has 30,000 employees. It's a vast organization. The person who is appointed there should have the conception that he's a trustee of the community. But that's where we failed, I think.
But you didn't find that?
Oh, no. I worked with a board of people who were there because they had rendered faithful service to various politicians.
I wonder how this reacts on your attitude. Did you, unconsciously have a sort of sense of disdain sometimes, and, you know, the whole thing, the other aspect comes in again?
Well, the position is this, that, if you reflect on the whole processes of democratic rule, you cannot overnight expect the maturity or work institutions that were evolved for a peculiar Western society in very peculiar circumstances, transplanted to Ceylon, and expect them to work in the same manner with the same degree of integrity, efficiency, balance. When you look at it in a mature manner, you would appreciate that we will have aberrations, distortions, we will make our mistakes. Everybody has not learned learned the practices and conventions of the Westminster Model Constitution. We only know the slogans. The boys who've done civics from Sinhalese and Tamil schools know the slogans of democracy. They know majority rule. May the majority be ruled. Well, hell, the minority rule. You don't prevail, that's all. That's so much of it. But I think in 100 years we'll have a very different type of constitution, possibly more adapted to the values we really respect.
With regard to corporations, one of the criticisms has been that sometimes civil servants who are sent to head them transfer their bureaucratic forms and procedures.
Yes, very great temptation. And in fact, it is a criticism that has been made about corporations in Great Britain. Having spent a lifetime following certain procedures, it's really difficult to shake them off. But again, as long as these are public corporations, it is very essential that they must be run in a manner which is apparently run with integrity. So you must follow rules and regulations which are subject to public, which can be scrutinized in public and justified in public. Mm-hmm. You're not doing it with your private money. I don't follow any rules and regulations spending my private money. But certainly as chairman of a public corporation, I do prescribe it in paper, on paper. Why I took a decision.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of, turning to another aspect, what do you think of the district council's plan with regard to its likely effect on guardianship concept and on identification between administrator and public?
You see, the administration intensely dislikes the idea of any district council of being any subject to any audit by elected representatives. They think that they are much better guardians of the public good than any locally elected village representative could be. But, maybe. But I have seen so many changes for the good after Dutch suffrage in Ceylon. I know the old attitude of British civil service, what the devil do these provincial proctors know about what the country needs? We know it better. We've got trained minds, we've got the university. But certainly body of social legislation has been enacted. A greater degree of social justice has been introduced into the administration of this country in the 30 years of adult suffrage than in the 150 years of paternal rule. Very simple things like, the peer and the minor employee until 1947 was not entitled to a pension. The chap who needed the pension most, who never in all his life earned an income which enabled him to put by something, was given a lump sum gratuity to become a dependent on his children. The better salaried individual was entitled to a pension. Again, of each group, there's some merit in Marx's thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly will give some degree of satisfaction, and maybe the administration will be able to mobilize much more local participation for government's endeavors like food production, Ramadan, improvement of rural conditions, housing and whatnot, than a bureaucracy is able to, working through paid employees.
On the other hand, couldn't it slow down decision making and execution too?
Oh yes, maybe. With popular democracy, there will be heaps of records organized. Every village council, the total budget is divided up by the number of members, and each member is given what he's to do. Maybe he gets a cut out of it. In our present state of development, that is so.
Let it be so.
Let it be so, I think. If that will give, until the community knows how to better what it wants.
Mm-hmm. And with all this talk about integrity in British times, how fair were they when it came to a case between a European and a Ceylonian? Either administrative or judicial, especially administrative.
I think in the judiciary, they were objective in the administration of the law. In administration, certainly when there was conflict of interest between Ceylonese and Europeans, the European point of view prevailed to a much greater degree because of the circumstances in which the GA lived. He heard his point of view over a glass of whiskey at the club. The Ceylonese point of view had to percolate through the Mudlia, who was the interpreter of the Ceylonese point of view. So,
it's as it works today in the sense that the people having the ear of the...
Yes, very much so. The person who has the ear of the minister gets his point of view. You know, in trying to get at abstract truth, sometimes a very arduous pastime, and not very many are inclined to engage in the arduous pastime.
I was also interested somewhat in the structure of the service and the question of integration, coordination both at the ministerial level, the middle levels, and at the provincial level. I'm aware of the recent report about the provincial level, but higher up?
You know, that is about really one of the problems, but you have a service of 1,000-odd people. How are you going to use them properly, effectively, and if they're going to be your key men in your administration, you must know them. The British work a large service on the basis of this, break them up into ministries. When you join, you choose your ministry. If you're lucky, you get the ministry of your choice, or you're assigned to a ministry. You spend the rest of your life there, unless something exceptional happens, and you may be shifted to... When you come right to the very top, as permanent secretary, you may be shifted to another ministry, or you may be in your own ministry. But invariably, you spend the whole of your life in that ministry. Here, we haven't done anything like that. An effort is to be made to maintain a transferable service. I think it will fail. We have to make the decision.
To go into this ministerial
groups. And there will be tremendous resistance. Every chap who has worked in the district is now aspiring. You see, everybody wants to serve in a club. Everybody wants a son or daughter educated at ladies' college of St. Thomas's or Royal or somewhere. Everybody who's been spending his time in the district is now thinking, I'm a member of a combined service, meeting his favorite politician and trying to shift in. We're too small a country, and yet politicians and ministers and everybody waste their time trying to help people to come in. So the importance of people specializing in their tasks and making themselves competent in doing some branch of work efficiently has not yet penetrated the political sector.
But then, given the administrator's outlook too, won't you find the whole administrative service fighting this reform, this sort of reform?
No, but, you know, the... If the administrative service is going to do play any part of an efficient sector of management, if they read anything about modern management, I think they realize that they have a role to play, an important role, only if they are able and have the capacity to study problems in depth. And to study problems in depth is not by reading the last page of a file. You've got to devote a lifetime to studying a problem and making a contribution towards solving a problem of the nation.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say that that appreciation is not there in the public service. It isn't there in the political sector. It'll take a very long time before we can achieve it. And we will have good administration only when we have a higher degree of specialization.
And isn't, as a result of all this, this lack of realization, hasn't this integration been hindered, or shall I say, hasn't disintegration occurred as a result of bad ministerial allocation? I mean, after each new government comes in, the way they divide the ministerships.
Oh yes, the ministries are created according to the exigencies of politics, not according to the needs of good administration. You know, you raise that issue. One of the strange things in the political life of our country is that there are very few politicians who have given thought to the machinery of government and how it could be used to realize political objectives. Felix Das Pandranaike was one of the ministers who was interested in the machinery of government. But
I can't imagine Pandranaike being interested.
You know, he had the capacity to be interested because he sent me on a mission, interesting mission to in 58 to India to find out what the Indians had done to adapt the ICS to conditions after independence. So he saw the necessity to adapt a public service which was brought up under colonial traditions to the circumstances of independence.
But that's a line a lot of people have been pushing.
Yeah. Yes, and the urgency of it, and the reforms that were ultimately introduced, we tended more to prejudice than to reforms which created a modern administrative service.
Presumably, if this sort of plan is to come about of ministerships, the initial choice has of the, you know, which departments to allocate has to be really well thought out.
Oh yes, you see, you have to make your decision as to how many are required in the various ministries. You have to have a projection as to how the ministries are likely to expand. You have to make your recruitment on that basis.
And how could you bring about ministerial coordination? Because even under this new system, you still need that, as you do now.
By ministerial coordination, is interministerial coordination or coordination at what level? What type of coordination?
Between each ministry.
Between each ministry. You know, the coordination between ministries was very much the function of the treasury of old. Treasury control represented coordination. Ministerial activities of ministries ultimately had a financial implication. Before you allocated the monies, you ensured that all interministerial relationships have been cleared. I don't think our treasury ever performed that function very satisfactorily. But now, to some extent, the planning secretariat, planning ministry, is trying to perform that function. Yeah, every proposal goes not merely to the treasury, but also to the planning ministry. The planning ministry endeavors to ensure some degree of coordination and some degree of that. A problem has been studied in depth before it reaches governmental decision. But you know, for coordination and sound study in depth, it requires a certain amount of ministerial discipline. Ministers must restrain themselves. And sometimes you find that a most important policy decision has been made when the minister is on his hind legs in the house. He's made an important pronouncement in Parliament. I am going to do this. He has never consulted any of his advisers.
Mm-hmm. Well, but with regard to the ministerial allocations themselves, you said it's due to political pressure. But again, isn't this inevitable, like, say, the rice business, that you can't go according to pure economics, you have to go according to political pressure?
You see, that in a democratic system, ultimately, politician must respond to pressures that elect him. They are important factors. But don't do that off the cuff.
Mm-hmm.
Once upon a time, I remember in 1960, we did sit together, a number of permanent secretaries, and say, this is a logical distribution, which we said we would offer to any prime minister who is elected, logical distribution of functions. We knew that the ministries, that would be around about 15 ministries. We created 15 ministries of interrelated subjects, and we were ready to offer it. But we found that decisions were made without any consultation with the permanent service.
I see. What about the question of friction between, say, within a ministry, and particularly between the technical departments and the administrative departments? And apropos of this, of course, the recent conference at which some of the technical people seem to have...
We follow very much the British pattern, where the person who advises the minister before he makes a decision is a generalist, a lay generalist. Technicians claim that they should be also in a position to advise. I have been in charge of a number of technical departments and a permanent secretary. Never prevented a technical officer, when he wanted to meet the minister, tender his advice, offering opportunity of offering that advice. And if they ask, what you want a minister, before a minister makes a decision, you want advice from a person who is aware of the circumstances in which the government operates. This question of coordination comes in. Technicians are very much alive to their own technical point of view. They are not alive either to the political circumstances or the economic circumstances. And sometimes many of them don't think it is their responsibility to be aware of it. At conferences they said, this is my technical advice, the economics of it, don't ask me, I'm not an economist. So, but there are others, some technical officers are very good, who are aware of the circumstances in which governments operate. But there is a growing resentment among technical officers that they are not playing a sufficiently important role. But I think much of the resentment is due to the fact that they are not afforded the opportunity in the public service of attaining the highest levels of remuneration. In my report on India in 1958, I said that India had got over that problem. They have kept the generalist as advisor, but they have given the competent technician a place, an important place, as a principal advisor in the ministry. Paid him remuneration as high as the permanent secretary. So he performs what he is most competent to perform. And he is available to advise the minister in making policy decisions at the time. And he suffers no inferiority complex because his remuneration is lower.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the solution in Ceylon everywhere should be that. And there should be, even under our present regulations, there's nothing to prevent the Prime Minister appointing a technical officer as permanent secretary. If ministers have not got technical officers as their permanent secretary, it is because maybe they have found their outlook is a little narrower than the outlook of a person who has had maybe who has due problems more broadly.
Mm-hmm. But won't the civil servant who views problems more broadly will you have this type under your other scheme of specialized ministries?
You see, what in a recent report on administrative reforms, what we suggested to government was that an officer in his cadetship and in his first 4 years must be allowed circulation. After that, he must get fixed to